She had no way to answer that. "I don't think I have the Morden gift you were telling me about, or if I do, I don't understand either one enough to know if they're similar. Back to what I was saying, my mother was a geneticist and my father an AI researcher. After I reached the age of 14, she chose to be uploaded. I felt abandoned, though she and I were never that close to begin with. I think my father might have wanted to join her, but he felt a duty to finish raising me, so he stayed. He continued his research and took care of me, but when I was 18, he had an accident. It was a simple slip, a fall, but he hit his head. He seemed fine afterward, but a few hours later he died from a ruptured blood vessel in his brain. He died so suddenly, he never had the opportunity, the freedom of choice, to upload himself." Matthew responded, "I follow you so far. So what is it that you were talking to earlier?" "That was an AGI, an artificial generalized intelligence. My father worked as a researcher in the field of artificial intelligence, and one of his pet projects was creating an artificial assistant, something like a digital clone of himself. It's a machine, so it doesn't have true awareness, but in every other way that counts, it is intelligent. He even gave it facsimiles of his own memories, and he named it after himself." He frowned. "This is really confusing." Karen agreed. "It's like a painting. It looks like my dad, it sounds like him, has many of his memories and knowledge, and it's programmed to act like him, as much as is possible. But it isn't actually him. It knows all of this, too, but it seems to prefer to treat me as though I'm its daughter." "And how do you feel about that?" asked Matt. She closed her eyes. "I miss my dad. The AGI he left behind is a lot like him, like a goodbye letter from a loved one. I choose to play along because I don't have anything else. What about your mother?" Karen's jaw clenched. "She's cold, more interested in her work than she ever was in me. Since she uploaded, I've been lucky to hear from her more than once a year. I'm just not interesting enough." He could feel the unspoken anger behind her thoughts. Karen was trying to hide the pain, even from herself, but it seeped through. He didn't know how to respond. Certainly, telling her about his own family life wouldn't help. They flew on, over the endless countryside of forest and rolling plains. To Matthew's eyes, it looked like a sad, empty world, with no sign of the billions of people who had once lived in it, if Karen's story was to be believed. From the air, he could see signs that it had once been different. There were odd patterns in the foliage and trees that indicated areas that were younger than others. Long lines of younger trees where there had been roads and rectangular patches of different coloured undergrowth that indicated now absent buildings. To him, it seemed like a world abandoned. Once the sun went down, there was nothing to be seen at all. It was a new moon, and they had only the light of the stars to guide them. Matthew's vision was good enough to make out some details in the landscape, but Karen was in a world of near absolute darkness, with only a vague difference to discern between the starry sky above and the black emptiness beneath them. Desiccus still had enough light to fly, but the requirement that he stay near the ground was becoming difficult to manage. So close to the earth, it was hard for him to spot every obstacle that needed to be avoided, and eventually he suggested they make camp. They lit no fire, since Karen informed them that their enemy would have no trouble spotting such a thing. She would have preferred to have one, though. Matthew rummaged through their things and brought out his sewing kit and her small backpack. Despite the lack of light, he began nimbly embroidering the last symbol onto the white strip he had sewn inside it. Karen watched, using her mage sight, surprised at how much she could perceive without visible light. It was a strange sensation, but she was gradually growing used to it. Her range was still very limited, but she had found she could see with it more clearly around Matthew and the dragon, as though they somehow illuminated the world near them. When he finished his sewing, Matt began speaking in a language that seemed unlike his usual one, and Karen could sense the energies playing around his fingertips as he traced the cloth inside her backpack with his fingers. As he finished his chant, there was a flash, the same light that was not light, that she was gradually coming to understand as Aethar. Satisfied with his work, he handed the pack to her. "Look inside." Gone was the canvas-lined interior, with various pockets sewn throughout. In its place was a grey space that seemed much larger than it should be. It was dark, but her mage sight could explore the interior easily, and it felt flat and hard on one side. Reaching in, her fingers found a cold, hard surface, as though her bag had been cut open and her hand had gone through to find a wide stone floor. Karen pushed her hand deeper until the bag was all the way to her shoulder. From the outside, she could see where her arm should be, extending well past the bottom, while her mage sight could sense that same arm sticking through inside a different space within the pack.
"That is some freaky shit," she observed.
It didn't shock her quite as much as it should have, though. She was already beginning to reconcile herself to the existence of magic, and she had read a lot of science fiction and fantasy novels during her youth.
"We should go find a call box, and you can make a bigger one. If you can make it fly as well, I'll start calling you the Doctor."
Matthew frowned, unable to follow.
"A fictional character," she explained. "He had a box that was bigger on the inside, and he could use it to travel through time and space."
His face lit up with understanding.
"I see. I can't travel through time, although I could take us to another dimension that might represent a close analog of the past or future of this one. But the bag would stop working then. The dimensional aperture is anchored in this frame, so it wouldn't work in another."
She sighed.
"It was just a joke."
He switched back to English.
"Well, I'm not a fictional character. I'm a real nutjob."
Karen started laughing. She knew she should probably tell him the correct word for wizard, but she figured she could wait a while longer. Chapter 16. They rose as the sun was just beginning to peek over the horizon, and after an unsatisfying breakfast consisting of their remaining bread, they began flying again. They had slept separately. Since their one sexual encounter, Matthew had been careful to maintain a certain amount of space between them. He hadn't spoken of their romantic interlude, and he wasn't inclined to repeat it. It had been a terrible mistake on his part, allowing it to happen, and he hoped Karen wouldn't push the matter. It wasn't that he disliked her. In fact, he was vaguely aware that he had become uncommonly fond of her, but it wasn't part of his plan in life. He had a duty to his family when he returned home. It was obvious to him that he couldn't bring a foreign girl home and expect to marry her, and he definitely didn't want to leave fatherless children behind if she elected to stay in this world. He thought she understood, as she hadn't brought it up since that night, but he still felt faintly uneasy about it. What if she was already with child? He wasn't sure how he would handle that outcome.
"One problem at a time," he told himself.
In the distance, he could see a change on the horizon, a long blue streak that probably signaled their approach to the ocean. They had almost crossed the island, and if Karen was correct, they would need to head north along the coast to find the River Orwell, which led where her aunt lived. A silent message from Karen interrupted his thoughts.
"You don't seem to be having as many problems as you did the first time you were in my world."
"I was using Aether faster than I could replace it before," he told her. "This time I have Desiccus close by."
"Are dragons the source of Aether?" she asked.
"No," he replied. "They actually don't even produce Aether like a normal living creature does, but my father stored a vast amount of Aether in them. I can draw upon it when needed."
"Like a battery," she commented.
The concept was a perfect analogy.
"Exactly," he agreed.
"What is your aunt like?"
Karen shrugged. "I don't know her very well. She visited us a few times when I was younger, and she always sends me birthday cards. I think she's probably a sweet lady, and no matter what else, she's family."
The underlying subtext of her thoughts registered clearly. She wouldn't betray them. Director Aisman sighed as a beep signaled the impending arrival of Dr. Miller. Seconds later, she appeared, sitting across from him on the other side of his desk.
"It's clear that the targets did indeed escape before the strike in Colorado,"
she began without preamble. He leaned his elbows on the desktop and put his hands together in front of his chin.
"Our men damaged a lot of military hardware, making certain they couldn't leave before the munitions arrived."
"And now she's in southern England," stated Dr. Miller, pressing her red lips together in a firm line. "I almost made contact with her. Any idea where she is now?"
"Our drones were destroyed right after we cut off the terminal she was using,"
began the director. Tanya Miller leaned forward, her smooth features twisting in anger.
"The terminal your agency shut down before I could get through to speak with her. Idiots!"
Esmond leaned back, controlling his temper.
"I deemed it too great a risk. She was passing information and instructions to a third-party AGI. There's no telling what that thing might do. We have to isolate her if we are going to capture her."
"Your chances would be a lot better if I had had the opportunity to speak with her, Director. The girl trusts me. I am her mother, after all. Next time you will wait for my order before making a move like that."
Director Aisman could feel the blood vessel on one side of his face begin to twitch.
"As I said before, Dr. Miller, there was an unknown AGI involved."
Dr. Miller cut him off once again.
"It was probably that hideous effigy of himself that Gary made. It's harmless. What you did was pointless, the equivalent of taking a doll away from a child. But now you've made her even more paranoid."
"Your pardon, Dr. Miller, but your husband was one of the top scientists involved in the ANSYS project, and a highly respected researcher. We have no idea what that piece of code he left behind might be capable of."
Tanya leaned forward.
"From this point forward, Director, you would do better to worry about what I am capable of, if you like your post, that is. Am I understood?"
Her words struck him like a slap, but he kept his composure.
"Perfectly, Doctor."
"Good. Now, what do we know about their current location?"
"Satellite image analysis shows them somewhere close to Rochester. They don't show up on every shot, and it's difficult even for the image ASI to pick them out, but we're confident that they're heading northward. You have family in Ipswich," reported Aisman.
"Gary's sister, Roberta," said Tanya. "She was always backward, unwilling to adapt. She was one of the last to get implants."
Director Aisman looked worried.
"If they make contact with her, we'll have their position, but Ipswich is densely populated. We can't risk a major use of force there."
"If the situation requires it, we will do whatever is necessary, Director. Australia was no accident. This isn't a game."
Tanya Miller leaned back in her chair.
"For now, the risk seems smaller than I initially thought since we found no evidence of infection in Colorado. You can tap into Roberta's implants, correct?"
Aisman nodded.
"Then we'll observe for now. We may learn something. If we discover reason for concern, we will move with decisive force in Ipswich. If not, we can wait until they leave the city. I'm starting to think it might be useful to bring Karen in alive, if possible."
"That should be a relief for you, then," commented Aisman.
Tanya frowned.
"Why?"
"She is your daughter, after all."
Dr. Miller's lip curled.
"She's a failed experiment, Director. Nothing more."
She paused and then added,
"Or perhaps not. It may be that she has begun to develop."
Donald Aisman suppressed a faint shudder at the coldness in her tone. Whatever Karen Miller was, he felt sorry for her. No one should have such a monster for a mother. Tanya ignored his discomfort.
"Inform me when they make contact, or if the situation changes. Until then, keep the drones away. We'll rely on more passive means of surveillance to avoid tipping our hand."
"That's Ipswich ahead," said Karen.
"Are you sure?"
asked Matt. She nodded.
"There aren't any other populated areas left in this region. Can you make Desiccus invisible?"
He wasn't familiar with several of the words she used.
"Explain. Can you hide the dragon? Make him invisible?"
she asked mentally, repeating her question. Matthew shook his head.
"No, only the Praetheans have that gift. I guess it was too much to hope for. We will have to leave him here, then, to avoid creating a panic."
"I can disguise him," suggested Matthew.
"Make him look like something else."
"Camouflage?"
"An illusion," he told her,
agreeing with the basic idea.
"I just need an image of something close to his size that people would find normal."
He nodded.
"A drone would be too small."
"A pert," she told him.
"We use them to move around and carry things. It's like a flying car."
Matthew could see an image in her thoughts, but it was indistinct. Mental images were usually like that, especially in the minds of people who weren't mages. Wizards were taught to sharpen their mental images,
and long practice made it easier, but most people had no need for such exercises.
"Think of it," he told her.
"I'll create a visual and try to improve it until you think it looks right." Following what he could see in her thoughts, he started with a grey rectangle that tapered on either end. The corners and edges were rounded, and various lines marked the places where separate pieces connected, denoting doors and windows. It had four circular protuberances at each corner, and gradually he came to understand that those were fans of some sort. Karen watched what he was doing with interest, and she was able to refine her mental picture as she looked at it. His illusion improved with each passing moment, reflecting her revisions.
"It's better," she told him, "but it still doesn't look quite right."
She continued adjusting her mental picture, but it was like trying to sculpt a car from wet clay. She realized she had never really examined her pert that closely before. She could point to any given part and tell it wasn't quite right, but some of her changes only made it worse. It looked like a child's painting of a pert. Abruptly, the image stopped changing, and its lines sharpened. The surface smoothed and became more realistic, though it still wasn't right.
"That wasn't me," Karen stated.
"I know," said Matthew, his lips forming a faint smirk. "It wasn't getting any better, so I decided to fix it." His patronizing tone irritated her.
"It still isn't correct."
"At least it looks solid," he remarked, and then climbed up on Desica's back. Leaning over, he held out a hand to help her up.
"If we see one when we fly over, I can improve it."
Grudgingly, she pulled herself up with the aid of his proffered arm. She refrained from responding to his comment. The clumsy image of the pert moved sideways and settled around Desiccus. It was partially transparent from within, so they could see out with their normal vision. It didn't impair mage sight at all, but mage sight didn't have the necessary range one would desire while flying, especially in her world.
"My tail and wings are sticking out," observed the dragon.
Matthew nodded, and the illusion expanded until it was large enough to cover him completely.
"Noted."
"Now it's too large," said Karen.
"In the air, distances are subject to observer bias," explained Matthew. "As long as we are not too close, the viewer will account for the size by thinking we are closer than we actually are." Once in the air, Desiccus flew at a much higher altitude than what they had been traveling at, though it was still far from what he considered high. They were only around 2,000 feet up. Karen assured him it was the proper height for a pert over the city, though. There wasn't much traffic over Ipswich, but as soon as they spotted another pert, Matthew directed his dragon to fly toward it. The illusion around Desiccus improved steadily as they approached, and by the time they passed the other vehicle, at a distance of several hundred feet, Karen could tell their illusion was close to perfect. It didn't waver afterward either. Matthew's mental reproduction of what he had seen was rock solid.
"How do you make it so perfect?" she asked him.
"The Praetheans are generally the most skilled with illusions," he told her. "But I do have the advantage of an infallible memory." That didn't reconcile well with what she had been taught concerning the brain.
"True photographic memory is a myth," she replied. "No one has perfect recall."
"I do," he answered.
"You would, too, if you had a seed mind like the children of the Shi'ar."
"Is that how you do it?" she asked.
"No, I am not of the Shi'ar. I just inherited one of their gifts, and their knowledge," he explained. "My memory seems to be a side effect of that."
They passed one or two more perts as they made their way to the central portion of Ipswich, and descended into a strange open area with rectangular lines drawn across a smooth, stone-like surface.
"Land inside one of the parking spots," Karen advised him.
He assumed she meant one of the rectangles. As they dropped lower, he decreased the size of his illusion gradually. Inevitably, there were a few moments where Desiccus's wings and tail extended beyond the boundary, but once they were on the ground, he folded them up and curled up to fit within the illusion. Matthew doubted anyone had noticed the brief discrepancy.
"Where are all the people?" he asked Karen.
There were several other perts parked in the lot, but the streets and buildings seemed empty. Occasionally a pert or drone would fly by, however. She shrugged.
"At home, people don't get out much anymore." "Oh, there's someone."
She pointed down the smooth, black-topped road where a figure had rounded the corner. Matthew raised his staff defensively and created a shield when he saw the mechanical creature,
assuming it was one of the strange soldiers he had fought before. But Karen put a hand on his shoulder.
"Slow down, cowboy. It's just a regular person," she whispered in his ear.
They were still standing beside Desiccus, enclosed within the illusion of the pert, so there was no danger the machine had spotted them. Matt gave her an odd stare.
"That is not a person. It's an android," she stated.
When that didn't help, she switched to mental communication.
"An android, a robot that looks like a person."
"As I said," he responded, "it isn't a person." She shook her head.
"Yes, it is. People who have been uploaded occasionally use them to interact in the physical world. It might even be an organic who just doesn't want to leave the house. Either way, it's a person. I'm going to talk to her."
"How do you know it's a her?"
"It's wearing a summer dress, so it's either a woman or someone who prefers to be identified as such. After being uploaded, gender is sort of a moot point anyway," she replied.
There was an awkward moment as she squeezed around the dragon to slip out of the illusion on the opposite side. Matthew had never seen a pert's doors opening and closing before, so it was better to exit on the side the android couldn't observe. Before she stepped out, he touched her shoulder and sent a fine thread of Aethar outward as he mouthed a strange word. Her skin changed colour, hiding her unusual blue tone.
"Stay here," she told him.
Then she walked around the dragon and headed for the android. As she had pointed out, it was wearing a lovely floral print dress. She could tell the android was one of the newer models, for while it was still obviously a machine, it moved fluidly, and its surface was covered with an almost lifelike surface in a natural beige tone. Matt watched and listened carefully. Karen approached the man-shaped thing almost 30 yards distant, but his dragon-enhanced hearing was more than adequate to pick up what they were saying.
"Hello," began Karen.
The machine had focused on her as she approached, and it smiled at her greeting.
"Hello. I need directions, if you don't mind."
The android's face developed a look of faint concern that was close to a normal human expression, but the subtle differences only succeeded in making Matt's skin crawl. Its voice was feminine as it replied,
"Are your implants malfunctioning? There's a medical facility not far from here, if you need assistance."
Karen waved her offer away.
"No, I don't have implants. It's a medical condition. I have to use a PM, but I lost it. I need to find the office of a friend here in the city."
The female android's mouth opened in an O of surprise, and her features showed something like pity.
"I'm so sorry. I didn't realize. I didn't mean any offense. Which office are you looking for? I'd be glad to look it up."
Karen looked embarrassed.
"I don't know the name of the office, but I'm looking for Roberta Plant, an estate agent who works in Ipswich."
The android paused for only a second before responding.
"She works for Nicholas Estates. Their branch office is in the Building Society building on Henning."
The machine added an address that meant little to Matthew.
"I'm not familiar with the city," said Karen. "Which way should we head?"
"East. The A14 is just south of here. Follow it across the Orwell Bridge, and then look for Nacton Road. Go left from that intersection and you're almost there,"
answered the android. After a second, it stuck out its hand.
"I'm April, by the way."
"Karen," she said, and took its hand.
"Sorry, I should have introduced myself sooner. Thank you for your help."
Matthew gave her an odd look when she returned.
"Is your aunt like that, too?"
She laughed.
"Oh, no, I doubt it.
Aunt Roberta isn't convinced that uploading is a good thing yet. She did finally get implants, but I'd be very surprised if she ever uses telepresence."
"Telepresence?"
Karen tried to explain mentally. "Androids like that can be used by those who are uploaded, to operate in the physical world. But some organics with implants also use them when they would rather not leave the house. The person I was talking to could be a normal person at home, or it could be a fully digital person."
Matthew was even more confused. "What's the difference?"
"Someone who is uploaded would likely be using the android directly, transferring their core into the machine, whereas someone with implants would be using it remotely." She struggled to find a good analogy.
"It's like the difference between riding a horse and becoming a horse when you need to go somewhere."
"Oh," said Matthew at last. The concept was foreign,
But he thought he understood the gist of it. Maybe.
Chapter 17. When they finally stepped into the office, they were greeted by another android, though this one was dressed in clothes that Karen assured him were masculine in nature. The machine had a helpful name tag on his chest that said, "Andrew." "Can I help you?" asked the android, giving them both an up-and-down look as he appraised their strange clothing.
"I'm here to see Roberta Plant. Is she in?" asked Karen.
Matthew was busy studying the plethora of strange objects that adorned the interior of the building. The floor was covered in a strange rug that seemed to stretch from wall to wall. He wondered how they managed to clean it, since it was almost immaculate, and yet there was no obvious way that he could see for the inhabitants to remove it for cleaning. The furniture in the room was equally bizarre. Some of it was constructed from wood, but other pieces were made of metal or smooth, glass-like materials. All of it was exceedingly plain. Everything was constructed with perfect lines, smooth and unmarred by wear and tear, but it also lacked much in the way of carving or other decoration. The walls were a stark white, with no sign of any blemish or imperfection. Beneath the surface, he could detect some sort of oddly uniform blocks made of a stony material, but they were covered with a material that reminded him somewhat of plaster, although it was clearly different.
"Are you a client?" asked the android,
watching Matthew with an odd expression. The young man was staring about him in wonder at the room. Karen started to explain that it was her aunt, but at the last second she decided it might be better not to do so.
"Possibly. I had some questions for her about a property."
Andrew seemed suspicious, and his eyes kept returning to Karen's makeshift wool shirt.
"Perhaps if you could tell me which property it is you're interested in."
A woman's voice came from the hallway behind him.
"Andrew? Is someone here?"
A moment later, the owner of said voice looked around the edge of the doorway from her office. Twinkling blue eyes looked at them from a round face.
"Oh, goodness! We do have visitors."
Andrew turned toward her.
"I was just asking about their business."
"No need. Send them in,"
ordered the woman. A moment later, Matthew found himself seated in what was possibly the strangest chair he had ever encountered. It had a metal frame that seemed to be all of one piece, supporting the cushioned seat and bending into a rounded rectangle to act as legs. It was upholstered with a strange fabric, and the seat seemed as though it was moulded to conform to his posterior. It was so soft, he felt immediately uncomfortable. Roberta and Karen had just finished a long, and to Matthew, overly emotional reunion hug. Karen's aunt had visible tears in her eyes when she sat down across from them.
"I can't believe you're here," she exclaimed. "Why didn't you tell me you were coming? And what on earth are you wearing?"
"It's a long story," began Karen. "But I think it might be best to tell you everything this evening. I didn't really know I was coming until yesterday. I'm in a bit of trouble."
"Even yesterday? You could have called or sent me a message,"
chided her aunt, before changing topics suddenly.
"Oh, where are my manners? You haven't introduced me to your friend."
She gave Matthew an apologetic look. Karen started to explain that Matthew didn't speak their language, but he was already rising from his seat. Leaning across the desk, Matt extended his hand.
"A pleasure to meet you. My name is Matthew Elinial."
"Roberta Plant,"
responded Roberta, with a smile that was entirely genuine.
"Is that armour? Are you a historical enthusiast?"
Her aunt had always been an extremely sociable woman, and she was certainly not shy about asking questions. Karen's father had remarked on it numerous times, but this was Karen's first time experiencing it as an adult herself. Matthew got the gist of her first question, but the second stumped him.
"Armour, yes."
He glanced at Karen for help.
"He only recently learned English, so he doesn't understand everything you're saying, Auntie,"
cautioned Karen. Roberta waved her hands.
"Nothing the auto-translator can't handle, I'm sure. Though it must be a little awkward for you, my dear."
She addressed Matthew.
"Where are you from?"
The question was simple enough for him, but he still didn't know how to answer. He gave Karen a helpless shrug, unsure how she wanted to handle it.
He doesn't have implants, Roberta, Karen informed her. He's like me, and I've lost my PM, so I have no idea what language he speaks.
Roberta frowned.
You know how strange all this sounds, dear. You show up out of the blue, wearing... Is that a poncho? You've an odd young man with you, and you're not sure where he's from. Does your mother know about this?
I haven't spoken to her, said Karen stiffly. We were lost in the mountains, in Colorado. I spoke to Dad, though, first chance I got.
Her aunt's face showed distaste.
That thing is not your father, Karen. I know Gary made it, but it's a sad substitute at best. Still, why didn't it call me?
Probably because you wouldn't take his call, thought Karen uncharitably. She loved her aunt, but the woman was rather prejudiced when it came to artificial intelligence. She kept that thought to herself.
I don't know. I only spoke to him yesterday.
You didn't fly wearing those clothes, did you?
Another question that she knew had no sensible answer.
We didn't fly, exactly. Well, we did for part of the journey, but we had to avoid commercial airlines.
Roberta's brows furrowed suspiciously.
What does that mean?
I'm in a lot of trouble.
The older woman shot a brief but withering glare at Matthew.
Are the police after you?
No, protested Karen. At least, I don't think so. I haven't done anything wrong, but it seems like the military are looking for me.
Her aunt sat down suddenly, shocked.
Oh, my God, she said quietly.
Karen started to say something, thinking she could reassure her somehow, but her aunt waved her hands.
Shush! Give me a minute.
What's she going to do?
Asked Matthew silently.
I don't know.
Finally, Roberta spoke, leveling her gaze at Karen.
Do you think they know you're here?
I don't think so. They may know we're in England. A couple of drones spotted us, and a public terminal died after I started using it in Tintagel. But if they know more than that, I doubt it. They actually shot at me in the mountains near home. There were dozens of soldiers there, and they didn't even warn me first. I was hiking. I met Matthew, and then, shortly after that, they started coming after us.
Her aunt's eyes flicked to Matt and then back to her. When she spoke again, she used Russian.
Is he one of them?
Karen frowned, taking a second to register what she had been asked. She had studied Russian for several years in college, but it was a surprise to hear it from her aunt. As far as she knew, the other woman didn't know any other languages.
She's using the auto-translator, Karen realized.
Unfortunately, the question still didn't make any sense to her. Slowly, she pieced together her response. She hadn't practiced Russian in a while.
What do you mean, them?
Roberta's response took several seconds while she waited for the translator to work, then provide her with a translated reply.
I don't want to say the name, because he might recognize it. I am referring to the ones that we fought in the Demon War.
Now she understood, and she blurted her answer out in English.
Oh, no, he's human, but Matthew is from another world.
Roberta's visage was worried, but she continued in her badly accented Russian.
What happened before? They were probably after him. If they don't know you were with him, you might be able to get out of this. You could go to my house, and I'll stay here with him. If I turn him in...
Matthew watched them curiously. He wasn't sure what was being discussed since they had switched languages, but he could make a broad guess. When Karen showed signs of being offended, it confirmed his theory.
No, said Karen firmly. He did nothing wrong, and if it weren't for him, I probably would have died in the mountains. They didn't even talk to us. They just showed up and started shooting.
Roberta sighed. Switching to English, she announced,
All right, dear. I think this is a mistake, but we don't have many options, do we? Let's go to my house. You need some proper clothes. You can explain more about how you got across the Atlantic while we drive.
Drive? Asked Karen, puzzled.
The older woman laughed.
An old expression, dear. We old folks used to actually pilot our own cars. Back then we called it driving.
I'll just tell Andrew that we're going out to look at some properties, and that I'll take the day off after that. Follow me, and don't say anything."
She led them back to the front office, and after a brief exchange with her co-worker, out the front door. They stood on the street for a minute when a pert appeared, flying in from wherever it had been stored, and hovering a foot off the ground in front of them. A side door opened, and Matthew could see some sort of cushioned seats inside.
"What about Desiccus?"
he asked Karen silently. With a nod, she spoke up.
"We left our pert parked a short way from here. Can you take us to pick it up first?"
Then she sent a reply to Matthew.
"Heaven help us if she sees your dragon. She might have a heart attack."
He smiled.
"Now that I've seen this one up close, I can make the illusion much more realistic." "It might be better to just leave it there," suggested her aunt, "in case they're tracking it already."
"That really isn't an option," said Karen.
"Do you have a garage?"
"What?" asked her aunt, briefly confused.
"Oh, you mean a car park. Sorry, dear. I misunderstood you. I should have known better. No one even uses gas in their vehicles anymore."
Now it was Karen's turn to be confused, but her aunt went on.
"I have a shed that I store my pert in, but it won't fit two of them. You'll have to park yours in the drive."
She relayed that to Matthew, and he told her not to worry. Desiccus will do better outdoors. A building would be too stuffy for him. If necessary, I can make him look like a tree or something. By then they had arrived at the car park, and Matthew got out to follow them. Karen worried needlessly about her aunt noticing any oddities about their disguised dragon, as the older woman seemed preoccupied with watching their surroundings nervously. Matthew mounted the dragon, and a moment later they were flying northward, heading for the small estate that Roberta called home. The residential area the house was located in was just as foreign to Matt's eyes as the city had been. A series of interconnected roads were lined with large houses, or at least he thought they were large. Karen assured him they were quite modest single-family homes common in the area. Roberta's house was a little larger than most in the area, and it had a small private yard both in front and behind the house. Grass covered the ground, and it was trimmed short, which was curious to him. In Lothian, only the very wealthy kept grass lawns, mainly due to the effort of maintaining it. Even in Castle Cameron, the only lawn was in a small garden within one of the castle yards. Here, though, every house in the neighbourhood had a trimmed lawn, no matter how small. He sent a thought to Karen as he followed behind them on Desiccus. "Is your aunt one of the nobility?" She seemed surprised.
"No, why?"
"Every house in the area has a lawn. Is this a wealthy district?" Karen laughed.
"No, everyone keeps a lawn.
Who maintains them? Do they all keep servants?" She began to understand his confusion.
"No, machines maintain the lawn. These days robo-mowers handle the majority of it, but my aunt probably has an android to handle more complex tasks as well."
"Like the one in her office?" he asked.
"No, that was a real person using an android body, though whether Andrew is an uploaded person or just an organic using telepresence, I don't know. If she has an android housekeeper, it would probably be operated by an AI," she explained.
Matthew couldn't help but shake his head. This world just got more confusing the more he learned. Karen and her aunt landed near a small outbuilding beside the main house. It had a wide door in the front that opened of its own accord to admit the pert. As per their plan, Matthew parked Desiccus in the drive outside.
"How long am I going to have to crouch here?" asked Desiccus.
The dragon was hunkered down with his wings folded and his tail tightly wrapped around his body to keep any part of himself from extending beyond the boundary of Matthew's illusory pert.
"I'm not certain," admitted Matthew.
Just then Roberta and Karen emerged from the garage. The older woman led them toward the front door of the house. As they walked, Karen made a suggestion.
"Why don't you send your pert to a public lot? There's no need to keep it here."
He thought he understood most of what she said, so he gestured at his illusory vehicle.
"Go."
Mentally, he added, "find a place in the trees. I'll change your illusion when I get a chance, so you'll be able to move around more freely." Roberta glanced at him oddly before entering the house.
As soon as she had gone inside, the dragon's wings extended, violating his camouflage for a moment as he took off. Matt enlarged the illusion to hide them again, and waited until the dragon had landed a short distance away, out of sight of the house. He was in a small cluster of trees, so Matthew altered the illusion to match. "Try not to move too much if there's anyone around," he cautioned the dragon. "People might panic if they saw several trees wandering around."
"It might be advisable for you to allow me to eat any that get too close," offered the dragon, his thoughts tinged with humor.
"Nice try," Matthew replied, then went into the house. As soon as the door closed behind him, Roberta turned to Karen.
"I thought you said he didn't have implants."
She was caught off guard.
He doesn't. "And yet he signaled for his pert to auto-park itself?"
pressed Roberta.
"And what was that ridiculous hand gesture?"
"Well," began Karen, struggling to think of a decent lie. It had never been her strong suit.
"It's time to be honest with me, Karen," insisted her aunt. "You're in serious trouble, and that man," she pointed at Matthew, "is a demon, isn't he?"
Chapter 18 Matthew watched their faces as Karen stared intently at her aunt, trying to figure out how to respond. The moment stretched out, and he spoke before either of them could say anything else.
"I'm here looking for my father. I did not mean to cause her problems."
Roberta's eyes focused on him.
"How long have you been here?"
"Less than a week."
"Your English is too good,"
Roberta responded, glancing briefly at her niece.
"No one learns a new language that quickly. How long have you been preparing for this? Studying us?"
There was a heavy undercurrent of suspicion in her voice. Karen spoke up.
"It isn't like that."
Roberta held up her hand to forestall her defense.
"Let him answer for himself."
Matthew considered the question seriously. In truth, his facility with her language was more than coincidental. His perfect memory was certainly a factor, but there was more to it than that. The more English he learned, the more he had come to realize it was probably a precursor to Barian, his own tongue. The grammar was similar, and many of the words were strangely accented variations of words in Barian. That knowledge had only served to confirm his theory that their world was a close relative of the way his own world had been thousands of years previously, before the Shi-Ha had come. Meeting Roberta's gaze squarely, he answered,
"I haven't studied your world at all. I think your language is an ancestor of mine."
Karen's aunt narrowed her eyes.
"Are you claiming to be a time traveler?"
He tried to think of a way to phrase his explanation, but his English was not up to the task yet. Frustrated, he reached out, thinking to touch Roberta's shoulder. It would be much easier to communicate with her mind to mind. As he raised his hand, a low growl caused him to pause. A dog had entered the front hall, and it was now staring him down with bared teeth. The dog was large and covered with a mix of greyish-black fur and lighter grey patches. Long, lean legs ended in large paws, and its ears were long. It appeared to be some sort of hound, though not of any breed Matt was familiar with.
"Annie, it's okay,"
said Roberta, putting her hand on the dog's head and rubbing softly. Looking back at Matthew, she apologized.
"Sorry. Annie probably sensed the tension. She's normally very friendly. Maybe we should sit down before we finish this conversation. Would you like some tea?"
She directed them to a comfortable-looking room with a large and well-cushioned couch. Matthew was just starting to sink into it when they heard Roberta yell from the kitchen,
"Annie, what did you do?"
Naturally, they both ran to see, and were greeted with the sight of a kitchen in chaos. Karen's aunt was shaking a finger at a very guilty-looking hound. The floor was covered in what appeared to be some sort of soup. A large pot lay overturned on the floor beneath the kitchen table. Roberta had set a timer that morning to start the pot simmering before she got home, and apparently Annie had decided she was a fan of bean soup. Standing on her hind legs, Annie was nearly as tall as a person, and she had managed to pull the pot down. It was a wonder the dog hadn't been burned. The accident had obviously happened an hour or two previously, for the food on the floor was cold.
Not all of it had gone to waste, though, for some parts of the floor had been licked clean. Matthew fought to restrain a smile at the scene. He looked at Karen.
"Want me to help?"
She felt his power begin to move, stirring at the food on the floor.
"No,"
she blurted out suddenly, earning a strange stare from her aunt.
"Go sit down. I'll help clean it up."
Mentally, she added,
"You'll frighten her if you do something like that. Wait until you've explained everything."
He accepted that quickly enough, but there was something else pressing for his attention.
"Since you don't need me, I'll excuse myself. Where are the privies?"
Karen wasn't sure what he meant, but Roberta took his meaning.
"Down the hall, first door on your right."
He nodded and turned in that direction. He hadn't known the proper word to use in English, but apparently it was the same as in Beren. Over the past week they had spent all their time outdoors, so handling personal needs had been straightforward, if not always comfortable. He expected that the first door on the right would be an exit leading him toward an outbuilding, but his mage sight contradicted that for him before he had even opened the door. It was a closet of some sort, or perhaps a washroom. The floor was composed of polished tile, and there was a white basin extending from the wall on his left. The basin had a drain in the bottom that led to what his mage sight could tell was a pipe. There was an apparatus on top that had levers of some sort on either side, both of which were supplied by water. He wasn't certain how to operate them, though. On the right, a low bowl with a large white rectangular box above and behind it caught his attention. He could sense the water within, though it was covered by a lid of some sort. Opening it, he saw an inviting pool of fresh water. "Maybe that's for washing up," he told himself. He still wasn't certain where he was supposed to handle his more serious business, so he continued to explore. A partially transparent door across from him opened into a small cubicle with a drain in the floor. The wall had another set of levers, and a spigot of some sort was set high up. With his mage sight, he could sense the pipes that fed water to it. After considering it for a moment, he wondered if it was meant for elimination. The setup made it possible, but the drain had a strange grate built over it that would probably block his solid waste from exiting easily.
"None of this makes sense," he admitted.
Most likely they had misunderstood his needs. It was ridiculous to think anyone would defecate in their own home to begin with. Glancing back at the wall-mounted basin, he decided it was probably only meant for liquid wastes, since it was mounted at waist height. He would have to explain himself better when he returned. For now, he could at least take care of one of his problems. Unfastening his trousers, he relieved himself in the basin. Afterward, he glanced back at the washbowl full of water. Sniffing at himself, he decided it might be wise to take the opportunity to wash up a bit. He removed his shirt, bent over, and started to use a hand to lift water up to his armpits, but he knew that what he really needed was a washcloth. A large towel hung from a rack on one wall, but he figured that was probably for drying. Then he noticed the roll of white tissue beside the washbowl. Unrolling some of it, he marveled at its fineness and soft texture. When he had a good handful, it pulled away easily, and he dipped it into the water to wet it before using it to scrub at his underarms. Unfortunately, it began to disintegrate as soon as he started rubbing, leaving bits of wet tissue stuck to his skin. He sensed Karen approach the door, and, of course, with her newly developing mage sight, she could see the broad outlines of what he was doing within.
"Matt?" she said through the door.
"Yes?"
"What are you doing?"
"Washing up," he told her, as he reached into the washbasin once more. Able to see his action, she recoiled.
"Stop! Don't do that!"
"What?" he said, pausing.
"Oh, my God! Open the door!"
His shirt was off, but it wasn't anything she hadn't seen, so he complied.
"This room is very strange," he told her.
Karen pointed at his wash basin.
"First, that's a toilet."
The look on his face told her that he didn't understand, so she expanded on the remark mentally.
"That's where people shit. The stuff in your hand is meant to be used for wiping your ass afterward."
He stepped back from the toilet suddenly, and then, almost as an afterthought, he dropped the wet tissue to the floor where it formed an amorphous blob.
"Oh!"
He started to wipe his hands on his trousers, but she stopped him.
"No, wait! The sink!"
She pointed at the place he had just used as a urinal.
"This is the soap,"
she demonstrated the liquid soap dispenser, washing her hands as an example.
"Then you use the towel."
Giving him a thorough examination, she added,
"But I think you should probably just take a shower at this point."
She explained the shower to him and directed him to leave his clothing on the floor.
"I'll see if my aunt can have them washed for you. She probably has a robe you can use after the shower."
Before she left, he looked at the toilet.
"People really shit in there?"
"Yes,"
she nodded in exasperation.
"Push this lever to flush afterward. You can put the toilet paper in there as well."
Turning away, she left. As she walked away, she heard him talking to himself through the door.
"That's disgusting."
2 hours later, all three of them were finally sitting in Roberta's living room. Matthew was wearing a robe that was far too short for his long legs, while Karen had borrowed a pair of her pajamas that were a couple of sizes too large for her frame, though they still only reached her mid-calf. Matt was pretty sure she had gotten the better deal, as he was constantly fidgeting to make sure the robe kept him modestly covered. It had a habit of gaping in awkward places, so he had to remain aware of his sitting position to avoid flashing his hostess. Roberta, for her part, seemed to enjoy his discomfort. At one point, as he realized he had begun to show too much, he looked up and met her gaze. She graced him with a smile and a wink, before returning to her conversation with her niece. Since he had showered first, Karen had used that time to explain most of the particulars of their situation to her aunt.
"I don't mind admitting, I have trouble accepting everything you've told me,"
Roberta told her niece.
"Not that I think you're lying, dear. It's just a lot for me to wrap my old brain around."
Karen sighed.
"I wouldn't believe it myself if I weren't stuck right in the middle of it. The part that's hardest is the dragon. I can believe that different creatures exist on other worlds. The Shi'ha did a good job of making sure no one could ever doubt that again. But I saw the pert Matthew followed us in."
Matthew was getting better at English, and Karen was sending him occasional mental explanations to help him keep current with the conversation. He chose then to speak up.
"I can show you."
Karen shot him a warning glance, worried that whatever he was planning might frighten her aunt, but he just smiled.
"Trust me,"
he sent to her. Standing up, he formed an image in his mind, and then used his will and his Aethar to give it an optical presence. Roberta gasped as his appearance shifted. He was no longer clad in a too small robe, but in the clothes he had arrived in, though they now appeared clean and unrumpled. He reached up to his neck, and when his hand came away, he was holding the robe he had been wearing.
"How did you do that?"
she questioned.
"Those clothes were in the washing machine."
"They still are," Matthew assured her.
"I am naked."
Stepping closer, he invited her to touch his sleeve. Since he was clad in nothing but illusion, her fingers passed straight through, finding only skin beneath them. He started to return to his seat, but she interrupted him, pointing at the robe he had discarded.
"Put it back on, please, dear. I know you look clothed, but I'd rather not have your bare ass on my couch."
Karen stifled a laugh. Matthew redressed himself with the robe, but he retained the illusion. At the very least, he could now sit without having to worry about keeping his legs crossed. Roberta went to the front window and looked out.
"Your pert is gone. Does that mean you've made the dragon invisible?"
"No," he answered. "I can't do that. I changed his appearance. There are some extra trees across the street from your house now."
"It does look different over there,"
she remarked.
"Though I don't know if I would have noticed. It's a little frightening thinking a giant predator could be lurking so close without anyone being the wiser."
"Desiccus is very gentle," said Karen, coming to the dragon's defense. "He doesn't eat people."
Her aunt glanced down, running her hand over Annie's soft head.
"What about dogs?"
Matthew honestly wasn't certain. It was possible the dragon might have eaten wild dogs in the past, though he hadn't mentioned it. He resolved to add them to the list of things the dragon was not to eat.
"She will be safe, I promise."
Roberta didn't look entirely confident in his response, but she decided to move on.
"Karen,
Have you given any thought to how to get out of this mess you're in? I love you, but you know you can't hide here forever. They're bound to come looking here sooner or later.
I haven't broken any laws, started Karen. And from what you've said, there's been nothing in the news, so I think the military is acting in secret. If I go to the police and make my story public, surely they wouldn't be able to do anything.
Her aunt pursed her lips.
You are seriously underestimating how desperate these people are. You said your mother didn't know anything about him, correct?
She left a message for me, said Karen.
But she just sounded worried. I don't think she knows about what's going on.
Roberta frowned.
Don't be so sure. If she finds out, things will only get worse.
What do you mean? Asked Karen. She knew her aunt didn't get along with her mother, but she had never understood why. Her aunt pursed her lips.
I shouldn't say this. I never understood what my brother saw in her, but your mother has always put her work before you, or anyone else in her family, for that matter. She also did a lot of classified projects for the government. I wouldn't put it past her to turn you over to the military if she found out where you were. There, I said it. I know Gary would have disagreed with me, but that's how I feel, and I can't help that. I don't trust her, and I don't think you should either,
finished Roberta. She glanced over at Matthew.
Also, if you go to the police, what do you think will happen to him?
Karen was secretly relieved to hear that her aunt had a similar opinion of her mother, but the question about Matthew surprised her.
Matthew can just leave. He isn't trapped here. They don't have any way of following him.
He hadn't followed their entire exchange, but he had caught the gist of it.
I'm not leaving. I'm here to find my father, or if he's not here, to find out why they sent agents to my world.
At the same time, he stared at Karen. Did she really not care if he left? Logically, he didn't want her to become attached to him, but after what had happened between them, he thought she should feel something.
Karen looked away when she discovered his eyes on her.
Roberta spoke up.
I think you're biting off more than you can chew, young man, though your motive sounds noble enough.
The conversation just went in circles after that, until eventually they wound up sitting in silence. Eventually, Karen decided to call it a day and shifted topics.
Can I access the network?
Roberta waved her hands at the guest room.
You probably want to relax, I'm guessing. If you want, I think I have a couple of old visors left over. Since I finally got these damned implants, I don't use them anymore. Just make sure you don't do anything that might flag the authorities to your location.
Chapter 19 Matthew held a strange, curved piece of what he now knew was plastic in one hand. It was shiny black with a flexible band that was meant to hold it in place on his head.
"What is this supposed to do?" he asked.
Karen smiled.
"It's like my PM, but it allows you to experience the network in a more immersive manner."
The frown on his face showed her that her explanation hadn't helped at all.
"Put it on, and I'll show you my world," she sent mentally.
She demonstrated, and he followed her example, slipping it over his head.
"Now I can't see anything," he groused.
Reaching over, she touched a button on one side of his visor, and his world changed completely. He was standing in a forest glade. Bird calls reached his ears, sounding as if they had carried across a wide expanse, while above him the tops of the massive trees swayed slowly in the breeze. Several strange symbols floated in the corner of his vision, and lines of text hovered in a box in front of him. Matt was utterly disoriented. Making matters worse, his mage sight showed him a conflicting version of reality. While his eyes showed him an endless forest, his arcane senses told him he still stood in a small bedroom, enclosed by four walls. A woman walked into his field of view. She wore a pair of black-rimmed spectacles and had long brown hair pulled back into a ponytail. A bizarre dress that barely reached past her thighs was complemented by a white shirt.
"Is everything okay?" she asked, in Karen's voice.
He felt a surge of vertigo. Karen still stood on the other side of the room, wearing her own visor. That was what his maidsight told him.
Yet he was hearing her voice coming from the stranger in front of him, who, his mage sight definitely told him, was not